then is a necessity of the manifestation of the Purusha on the physical plane. But his birth, whether the human or any other, cannot be in this world order an isolated accident or a sudden excursion of a soul into physicality without any preparation passed to it or any fulfilling thereof hereafter. In a world of involution and evolution, not of physical form only, but of conscious being through life and mind to spirit, such an isolated assumption of life in the human body could not be the rule of the individual soul's existence. It would be a quite meaningless and inconsequential arrangement, a freak for which the nature and system of things here have no place, a contrary violence which would break the rhythm of the spirit's self-manifestation. The intrusion of such a rule of individual soul life into an evolutionary spiritual progression would make it an effect without cause and a cause without effect. It would be a fragmentary present without a past or a future. The life of the individual must have the same rhythm of significance, the same law of progression as the cosmic life. Its place in that rhythm cannot be a stray, purposeless intervention. It must be an abiding instrumentation of the cosmic purpose. Neither in such an order can we explain an isolated advent, a one birth of the soul in the human body, which would be its first and last experience of the kind, of a previous existence in other worlds with a future before it, in yet other fields of experience. For here, life upon earth, life in the physical universe, is not and cannot be a causal perch for the wanderings of the soul from world to world. It is a great and slow development needing, as we know, incalculable spaces of time for its evolution. Human life is itself only a term in a graded series through which the secret spirit in the universe develops gradually his purpose and works it out finally through the enlarging and ascending individual soul consciousness in the body. This ascent can only take place by rebirth within the ascending order, an individual visit coming across it and progressing on some other line elsewhere could not fit into the system of this evolutionary existence. Shall I carry on?
The next one too.
Yes. Nor is the human soul, the human individual, a free wanderer, capriciously or lightly hastening from field to field according to its unfettered choice or according to its free and spontaneously variable action and result of action. That is a radiant thought of pure spiritual liberty, which may have its truth in planes beyond or in an eventual release, but is not true of, at first, of the earth life, of the life in the physical universe. The human birth in this world is on its spiritual side a complex of two elements, a spiritual person and a soul personality. The former is man's eternal being, and the latter is his cosmic and immutable being. As this spiritual impersonal person, he is one in his nature and being with the freedom of Satchidananda, who has here consented to or willed his involution in the nescience for a certain round of soul experience, impossible otherwise, and presides secretly over its evolution. As the soul of personality, he is himself part of that law that long development of the soul of the soul. Okay. Let me just start here. Okay, I'll just start a little bit back. As the soul of personality, He is himself part of that long development of the soul experience in the forms of nature. His own evolution must follow the laws and the lines of the universal evolution. As a spirit, he is one with the transcendence, which is immanent in the world and comprehensive of it. As a soul, he is at once one with and part of the universality of Sachidananda, self-expressed in the world. His self-expression must go through the stages of the cosmic expression. His soul experience follow the revolutions of the wheel of Brahman in the universe.
So, in these two beautiful paragraphs, Sri Aurobindo is laying down the reasons or the necessity for the human beings being part of an evolutionary movement which is cosmic, and also of its being the individualization of that cosmic movement. So he sets to rest the variety of theories that are introduced earlier, are fielded earlier by him as to the possibilities of the human birth and death, the interregnum, as he calls it, of appearance and disappearance in a human body. Now, one of the first things is that the first thing it takes up is that the human being is not a freak appearance, that it isn't a single life for which an individual appears and disappears, that there is no existence before and after. And that reality has to do with the fact that there seems to be a preparation before. And he has introduced that earlier, that in our lives itself, there is a preponderance of certain kinds of proclivities, trainings. Already that there are skills well developed, and then there is a certain kind of a aim or intention, that a momentum that we develop through life, which travels on, in a sense, into other kinds of existences. So the priority of something before this life and its, you know, sort of succession in after this life are things that he is emphasizing there. It also arises from the observation that human existence is not a freak appearance in a cosmic sense. Human being is an established, phenomenon of nature. If, for example, we found a certain kind of species appearing in a single instance and disappearing, then we would not have any way of explaining its appearance and disappearance. It would be a freak, a miracle, or an intervention or incursion from some other plane, or just self-born, as they say, swayambhu, and just, you know, self, erased. But that is not the case. There is a cosmic persistence to the human being. And even though we seem to we see a world in which human beings are established in individual forms and lives, appearing and disappearing, and being replaced by other individuals, as it were, still there is a certain sense of a continuity of the human consciousness. And even in individuals, there is the same sense of the continuity of the human consciousness, which arises if we really study our own existence. So that is the first thing that he puts to rest, the freak appearance of a human life. The second one he deals with is the human being as appearing on the earth from other planes and going to other planes after this life. The phrase he uses there is using the earth as a casual perch, like a bird that comes from elsewhere and sits on this branch for a while, twitters and experiences whatever has to be experienced of that atmosphere, and then flies on to another world. So there again, he puts that to rest. He contests that by saying that this cosmic reality of the human being and its affiliation with the cosmic evolution makes that impossibility. That the human being is part of this cosmic cycle of growth, in which the birth and death of things are, on the one hand, a certain representation of eternity and time, and on the other hand, a natural automatism by which nature challenges eternity to become fully manifest. So that kind of a process, a cosmic process, is what the human being undergoes through what he calls these vast cycles. And the evolution takes very large stretches of time through which the human soul undergoes its own growth. So these are the arguments he takes up. And then the third argument, with which he begins the second paragraph that we did today, is the absolute liberty of the human soul. That is, neither is it freak born, nor does it come from elsewhere by any compulsion and go elsewhere by some compulsion, but that it is ranging freely at will from world to world, and it can be anywhere it wants to be. Now, it's a very interesting idea, and he says that this could possibly be the nature of the human soul in other worlds, in another reality, say for example a supramental reality, or could be the eventual future of the human soul. Now it's extremely interesting because there's a place where the mother is asked, where is Sri Aurobindo now? And the answer she gives is exactly in terms of what he says here. She says, Sri Aurobindo is wherever he wishes to be, because he is completely free. So this is what this paragraph is talking about, the absolute freedom of the soul. In other words, its complete lack of compulsion to any particular movement. Now then he goes on to explain the distinction between that part of us which is indeed always completely free, and that part which has accepted a certain cosmic movement, accepted to be part of this cosmic evolutionary movement. And this is a beautiful, short explanation of the entire drift of what Sri Aurobindo elsewhere expands as the Gita's distinction between the Akshara Purusha and the Shara Purusha, the immutable and the mutable self. Now, the immutable self is the transcendental being. It is the being ever unchanging and eternal, self-conscious and capable of infinite self-concentrations, which are its perspectives on itself. These perspectives each can be called a jiva. This self-concentration can also be called the action of para prakriti on Purushottama. So this is the mechanism by which the one knows itself as the many. But in its transcendental sphere, this self-knowledge is an eternal and unchanging self-knowledge of its own potentialities. Now, that then decides to enter into a process. And even in this sentence, I realize the paradox is contained, because if we say that, then already we are assuming a certain beginning point when actually there is none. So this eternal appearance of the birth of an evolutionary movement, moving through a succession of births, a succession of dawns, as the Vedas puts it, is what is spawned by a certain act of consciousness, an act of consciousness creating time. And so that is what he's talking about here, that one aspect of this particular eternal being is its own self-representation as mutability, as changefulness. And that changefulness is not an individual changefulness, but a part of a cosmic changefulness. This is what, in other words, Sri Aurobindo and the mother call the psychic entity. The psychic entity is the Shara Purusha. That has become a part of the cosmic evolution, but also that is the entire cosmic evolution. In other words, each of our souls is the entire cosmic evolution, while it is also a part of the cosmic evolution. That's why he says, as a spirit, he is one with the transcendence, which is immanent in the world and comprehensive of it. As a soul, he is at once one with and part of the universality of Satchidananda, self-expressed in the world. His self-expression must go through the stages of the cosmic expression. His soul experience follow the revolutions of the wheel of Brahman in the universe. So this compulsion to the wheel is something that the soul has itself chosen as the transcendent Satchidananda, because each of us is no other than that. So that is how Sri Aurobindo brings the whole argument full circle and shows how freedom and compulsion are both simultaneous realities in the soul's choice. So here we find that this soul personality, which has entered the cosmic movement, is evolving from life to life. And that is what the entire meaning and drift of rebirth is all about. And its entire trajectory is the fulfillment of the cosmic movement towards its own self-discovery as an individualized transcendence, a transcendent being that is the entire cosmic being and self-represented as an individual possibility in each being.
So, this psychic being and psychic entity, in that context, I was thinking that, I don't know whether everybody would agree with me, we do experience this duality, right? One does feel like a casual perch, and the other does feel like rooted in the, you know, this earth planet. So, can you talk about that?
Yeah, very true. That is actually not so much psychic being and psychic entity, but it is actually, that's also interesting, because here he has not particularly used those terms, but the psychic being as such is not something he has fully discussed here. As the part of the transcendent being that enters into the cosmic movement in an individualized form, he's talking about the psychic entity. But in the human individual, that psychic entity again self-formulates itself into the psychic personality or the psychic being. So as he says, he uses them a little bit interchangeably here. That's why he says, as the soul of personality, he is himself part of that long development of the soul experience. The soul of personality is the psychic entity. The soul personality is the psychic being. In the human being, both are present, as well as the transcendence is present. Now, as you said very truly, we do have this duality of experience. One is as if we were on a casual perch, as if this earthly existence is something which, we're just passing through, that we will, we have never come from anything else and will never go anywhere else. This is also the modern view of things, which has been a prioritizing of the material basis of things. So our material existence appears with the birth and disappears with the death. So that sense of the casual perch is an experience that we carry, but that is an experience of what Sri Aurobindo calls the temporal ignorance. And the temporal ignorance, is part of our experience because of the unconsciousness of the physical, particularly the physical, but unconsciousness of the physical prakriti, but also the tying of the mental and vital prakriti to the physical prakriti. So it is this complex
actually,
of unconscious prakriti.
When I was talking about the experience of casual perch, I was really referring to that, as if I'm a guest here. I mean, I came to experience certain things and I'll go back, that sort of, and sometimes if I don't understand things, it gives a sense of wonder or strangeness. I mean, which basically points to that, casual guest. I mean, not that it is affecting, but it is, that sense of guest, being a guest, is there.
Yeah.
That's what I refer
yeah.
to as the casual.
So there, in that case, what is happening, there are two things involved here. One is that the sense of appearing and disappearing, which is a function of the prakriti. But also, if you're talking about that sense of something which is has a touch of eternity, but still feels alien over here, then it is due to a stronger aspect of the Jivatman or of the transcendental being, with the psychic entity and psychic being more suppressed in that experience. Now, when the psychic entity and psychic being become more expressed in our experience, then there is the sense of the cosmic cycles and the evolution through many lifetimes in nature. So yeah, the duality between the transcendence and the psychic entity does act up in our life, and you're right in that sense that that plays its part in giving us, on the one hand, a sense of maybe an eternity which does not belong here, and on the other hand, a sense of temporality which is tied to the evolution of the earth.
Thank you.
That part where Sri Aurobindo is talking about the transcendental being is also very beautiful. That sentence I'd like to draw attention to. As the spiritual impersonal person, he is one in his nature and being with the freedom of Satchidananda, who has here consented or willed his involution in the nescience for a certain round of self-experience. Mm-hmm. Impossible otherwise, and presides secretly over its evolution.
So when he says impossible otherwise, he means impossible without being blindfolded. Is that what he means?
Yeah, exactly. Impossible otherwise, impossible without being, impossible without going through the sacrifice. That's well, very well put.
Mm-hmm.
Impossible without being blindfolded, folded without accepting the ignorance, without turning into its own opposite.
So how does that get reconciled with the fact that, I mean, it's at one stage it's impossible,
Hello?
But on the...
Hello?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I mean, how do you reconcile that on one side it's impossible, but at the same time that itself is realized only as a looking back, back after it's done, after the veil has been removed? So that seems kind of, in a way, paradoxical.
In a way, what? Contradictory?
Yeah, I mean, paradoxical, I would say. Yeah, contradictory, yeah.
Not really. You see, the thing is that, you know, these are the multiple poises of the soul. The transcendental being and its own entry into the cosmic cycles. The eternity and the appearance of successions, the ignorance and its evolution into its own self-knowledge coexist in the supramental knowledge. To supermind, these are experiences that are going on at the same time. But in the veiled experience of the soul of ignorance, of the cosmic movement in its evolution, there is a difference. This is the difference that you're talking about. Now, that difference is because the veil is a certain kind of self, you know, subjection to have a certain kind of experience. That's why he says impossible otherwise. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, how could the divine have the experience of his own opposite? How could he have the experience of not knowing what it is to be conscious? So that is the entire, you know, sort of partial experience of that part of the being on which the veil is put. At the same time, the entire experience, including the experience of the evolution, is simultaneously being had by another part of our being, which is unveiled.
Yeah, very beautiful. Yeah, so yeah, yeah, very nice. So it seems that the divine, if the divine wants the experience of the undivine, then he has to put on that veil.
Yes, exactly.
And the process of putting on that veil is what we call the force of Maya. Is that right?
Yes.
Devashisa, about the previous, I mean, just before this, what you were speaking about, can you say a few more words about, like, the relationship between the psychic experience and the experience of the, of your, of the cosmic consciousness, or of your eternity, or of the knowledge of your eternity in time? Is that kind of, are they both the same? Or does one include the other?
Of which two? Of the of the psychic entity and the cosmic movement.
Yes, yes.
And the transcendence. I mean,
the psychic entity.
Come
the,
again with your question.
The psychic entity, the our realization of the psychic and our realization of the cosmic worlds and of our eternity in time. Would you say they are all the same?
No, they're not the same. They are the same and they're not the same. Because that is the power, you know, the power of mind, of the overmental Maya, creates separate realities of all these three things. That is the reason why the veil is there. And what we experience as the veil is the differentiation of this one reality into these three realities. And so when you're talking about the relationship between the three, though they are the same being seeing itself in these ways, perceiving itself in these ways, each becomes a separate experience. And so that's the reason for what Sri Aurobindo calls the triple transformation. The fact that the individual psychic being must know itself to be one with the cosmic being first, then that individualizes the cosmic being in the separate individual, and then must know itself as the spiritual or supramental being, the transcendental being, which individualizes the transcendental being in that one individual. So that is the point at which the three coexist, and one has the supramental experience of the identity of these three. But prior to that, we are faced with a universe in which the three are completely separate, and we are struggling to equate them.
Thank you, Devashisa. Shall we read the next paragraph? Sita, shall I go?
Yes, 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 please.
The universal spirit in things involved in the nescience of the physical universe evolves its nature self in a succession of physical forms up the graded series of matter, life, mind, and spirit. It emerges first as a secret soul in material forms, quite subject on the surface to the nescience. It develops as a soul, still secret, but about to emerge in vital forms that stand on the borders between nescience and the partial light of consciousness, which is our ignorance. It develops still farther as the initially conscient soul in the animal mind, and finally as the more outwardly conscious but not yet fully conscient soul in man. The consciousness is there throughout in our occult parts of being. The development is in the manifesting nature. This evolutionary development has a universal as well as an individual aspect. The universal develops the great...
Now what happened?
Hello?
I don't know what happened. Sham, continue. I think some feedback we got.
Can you hear me now or no?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. This evolutionary development has a universal as well as an individual aspect. The universal develops the grades of its being and the ordered variation of the universality of itself in the series of its evolved forms of being. The individual soul follows the line of this cosmic series and manifests what is prepared in the universality of the spirit. The universal man, the cosmic Purusha in humanity, is developing in the human race the power that has grown into humanity from below it and shall yet grow to supermind and spirit and become the Godhead in man who is aware of his true and integral self. and the divine universality of his nature. The individual must have followed this line of development. He must have presided over a soul experience in the lower forms of life before he took up the human evolution. As the one was capable of assuming in its universality these lower forms of the plant and animal, so must the individual, now human, have been capable of assuming them in his previous stages of existence. He now appears as a human soul, the spirit accepting the inner and outer form of humanity, but he is not limited by this form any more than he was limited by the plant or animal forms previously assumed by him. He can pass on from it to a greater self-expression in a higher scale of nature.
So here, Sri Aurobindo is rounding up his argument, his presentation, by talking about how this psychic entity in the cosmos emerges through various kinds of forms, and then becomes individualized in the human being. Becomes individualized in the human being. And now it can become self-conscious of its further progress. So he says here, and then that cosmic power which has taken us this far has caused to emerge this psychic personality is now self-conscious in its choice of further progress. So he says, the universal man, the cosmic Purusha in humanity. So here again, there is the notion when you talked about the relationship between the psychic entity and the cosmic being. There too, there is an entire gradation of beings, one may say, occult beings. And there is something called the universal man, which is like the archetype of the human species. This is the original human soul with a capital H, capital S, that is individualized in every human being. That itself is, on the other hand, an aspect of the cosmic soul that has been evolving its variety of evolutes. So this is what, in a way, this term universal man is a very inviting term, because Rabindranath was using this term for his university, Vishwamano, universal man. And we can think about universalization, the cosmic being of each individual, in a way becoming a uniting with that particular archetype, the archetype of the human. And so the cosmic Purusha in humanity, and that is what is behind the projection of the psychic entity as the human soul, and therefore behind the production or the development of the psychic being or soul personality. So it is developing in the human race the power that has grown into humanity from below it and shall yet grow to supermind and spirit and become the God-headed man who is aware of his true and integral self and the divine universality of his nature. So that is the presiding entity, you may say, the universal man. And it's influence is what drives the cosmic motor in the human life. And that is what causes the psychic being to emerge and to go through its cycles of progress, and at a certain point become the leader of the march and take into its hand the meaning of this entire process leading to full self-revelation and experience. So, the whole progress of Prakriti and its forms as the vehicles for the evolution of consciousness, as we talked about earlier, science has looked only at the evolution of material forms, which is an aspect of the evolution of Prakriti. Prakriti itself has other kinds of forms that are evolving as well, which are vital and mental forms. But these are all in themselves the evolution of the Adhara, of the vessel. And on the other hand, there is the evolution of the consciousness, which as the psychic entity is inhabiting these vessels. And at the stage of the human being has accepted a certain vessel given to it by the universal man, the cosmic human being, the Manu. And that is what is now evolving within it, but with the power of reversing the equation so that cosmic soul, human cosmic soul in the individual will transform the vessel, will transform the Prakriti and assume its mastery over the instruments of its own self-manifestation. That's why he says over here, man is not limited to the form he wears today. He has the consciousness that is the human today, has worn other forms in the past, and will wear other forms in the future, with the difference that those forms in the past were compulsions of nature, but the forms of the future will be choices of the soul.
Mother talks about a universal soul for animals, for example, cats and dogs, for example, she mentioned. Is this universal man something similar but is more evolved? Because human beings have more individuality because they are more evolved. And how do you compare that concept of universal soul for cats with the universal man, for example?
Yeah, good question. Yes, you're right. It is the same in the sense that just as each species has its, mother somewhere calls it the genius, that term she's using in a very specific way, not as we understand it, but closer to genus, the genius of the species, she calls it. Genius of the species is that being, that cosmic being, that is the archetype of that species. So, cosmic universal man, Vishwamanav, Manu, is the same for the human being. It is the archetype of the human being. But there is a difference between the archetype of animals and the archetype of human being, in that the archetype of animals projects itself as a psychic entity into the animal vehicles, animal prakriti. but does not individualize itself and therefore has to, in a sense, you know, transmit its messages to the individual prakritis which obey these messages. That's part of the reason why there is a conditioning involved in the animal lives, which seems, you know, in spite of individual differences, idiosyncrasies, and behaviors, to be much more in tune with some sort of universal or cosmic nature. Animals do instinctively just mm-hmm. what is needed to be done. They move from moment to moment and they carry out certain tasks which seem to be miraculous to the human eye. And the reason for that really is that that psychic entity is not sufficiently personalized as a psychic being, so that the messages of the archetype acting through the psychic entity can directly have effect on the prakriti of each individual animal. In the human being, an intermediary appears. That intermediary is the psychic being. It's an individualized aspect of the Vishwamana. Now, in and by itself, the psychic being is an intermediary between the individual prakriti and the psychic entity. So its intermediary nature means that it actually individualizes according to the prakriti, individual prakriti, and its action in the world, the messages of the psychic entity, which are ultimately being transmitted from the Vishwamana. So here, the sense of individuality of the psychic being translates itself into the prakriti as the ego. This is what gives us such a predominant sense of being someone. Someone different, someone distinctive. So that kind of sense of individuality creates a problem.
I think we lost you.
So the sense of individuality that we develop as a result of this appearance of a new instrumentation in prakriti, the mind, the mental being, reflecting the sense of individuality of the psychic being, gives a certain disturbance to the universal movement. This is why mind splits us in a way. This is what is known as the original sin. This is what is known as the fall from the Garden of Eden. It is a fall not of our own making. That is where the whole Christian myth goes wrong. But a fall of nature's own making and of the choice of our soul. It is a fall that is a presage to a greater rise. And that's the reason why this disturbance that comes in, cutting off the direct instrumentality of nature, human prakriti, from the messages of the universal human, is what has to be remedied through the first of the second of the triple transformations. That's why the whole thing about the cosmic being comes in. We have to cosmicize ourselves. We have to bring the psychic being to the front and make it universal. At that point, we unite with the Vishwamana and further with the being of the cosmic evolution. So it is because that is not present, the psychic being is not present, that in a way there is a simpler harmony to nature and to the world of animals and plants that nevertheless suffer a compulsion to the processes of nature, but still mirror a certain perfection even in that compulsion.
Psychic being, I mean, this again, I'm a little stuck with this psychic being and psychic entity. When we say a being with that psychic word, it really refers to a person, right? I mean,
yes.
So in that paragraph where it he mentioned about the spiritual person and the soul of personality. So that the personality is the essence, right? Like that's how I related the soul of personality to psychic entity, which is probably wrong, and the spiritual person to the psychic being.
Yeah, no. Actually, the spiritual person is the transcendental being, and in the individualized form, it is the Jivatman. The soul of personality is the psychic entity. The soul personality, he'll use that term elsewhere, is the psychic being. The soul of personality, which is the psychic entity that has the possibility of expressing itself as a personality. Now, that personality as which it expresses itself, and here is there is a certain problem, as you pointed out, there is the possibility of a confusion. Because if we are talking about a personality, then is that not the person but an expression of the person? That becomes the question. But here, the soul-personality is a certain kind of a paradox in terms, because it is a presentation, not a representation. It is the soul as personality, not the soul projecting a personality. Personality belongs to
Prakriti.
Yeah, but
there he talks about soul of personality, not soul
right.
dash personality.
That's right. That's why here he is talking about psychic entity. Soul of personality is that which expresses in the human being also as soul personality. So in the human being, you have three. Here he's talking only of the two, a spiritual person, which is the transcendental being or Jivatman, a soul of personality, which is the psychic entity. And in the human being, that also expresses itself as the soul personality, the soul as personality, which is the psychic being.
So the spiritual person, can it not be seen as the the godhead of psychic? In other words, the psychic being has the potential to realize itself as the spiritual person.
Yes, absolutely, and that is its goal, because psychic being has to experience its realize itself as identical with both cosmic being as spiritual person.
I mean, the spiritual person includes the cosmic being.
It does include the cosmic being. In fact, that's why, as I was pointing out, this split has taken place due to the act of mental maya, over mental maya. But as a matter of fact, psychic entity and psychic being are the same. Psychic being and cosmic being is the same, and psychic being, cosmic being, and supreme being as a spiritual person are the same. So that reversal has to take place, and that realization of these stages has to occur in us.
Of course, ultimately everything has the one source, but for the manifestation, there are several parts, right? Like one is the being evolved, and the other is the essence that is purified and transformed.
Can you explain that a little more? Because by being evolved, are you talking about the prakritic part?
No, I mean not being as an action, the being evolved, like being evolved. Though individual, but it is the whole as the individual, and the other is the soul of personality, which is basically the purification, transformation of all these characteristics or nature, yes. Which is also part of the process. So basically for the manifestation, it became like two parts. Ultimately, it goes back to the being and its consciousness.
Yes, but you see, as you're saying, what you're calling the being is the cosmic movement. It's the cosmic being. So, do you mean the transcendental being?
No, I am talking about the psychic being evolving towards the spiritual being,
And the other
being,
one?
The characteristics or nature, which is basically vital, mental, all these principles,
that's the transformation.
Which are going to be transformed.
Right.
For the manifestation purpose,
as you said, there are two things. There is the evolution of the psychic being and the transformation of the nature.
Right. You were saying that two are the same, psychic entity and psychic being are the same. I was talking about this, that for in the manifestation, the idea of a person in the process of evolution and the idea of principles in the process of evolution. That's what I was trying to differentiate.
Yes. That when I said the two are the same, that is only, in essence. But in the manifestation, they are not the same. And that's the reason why the evolution of the being, as you say, must attain to the identity of these things. Must attain to the identity of psychic being and psychic entity. Must attain to the identity of the psychic being and the spiritual person, and also of the cosmic person. And on the other hand, it must also attain to the transformation of the nature in the key of each of these beings at each stage. So that's why the triple transformation, first the psychic transformation, then the cosmic, and then the supramental transformation. So these have to be realized. They are not the same in the manifestation, but they are the same in the supermind. Does that answer your question? Does that?
Sort of. I mean, we can take it offline, maybe.
Devashisda, so when we, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. So when we say the universe, the Vishwamanu, and when we say the, the group soul in the animals, and so when we say that the universal man has put forth that psychic, which is growing inside man, so now, does the universal man actively do anything, or is it a static something that we identify with at some point in our sadhana? Similarly, for the group soul, it has given out some certain set of properties to the animal, so to say. So after that, does it exist as of itself, or is this set of properties the very thing that we call the group soul?
So this group soul, the soul exists by itself, not the set of properties. That is the it's a very tricky thing. This whole thing about soul formation, where does it come from, etc., is a very tricky thing that Sri Aurobindo and the Madhukar talk about here and there, but don't really develop fully. It even includes notions of things such as nation soul, etc. Where does a nation soul suddenly come into existence, for example? I mean, nation may not come into existence except historically. At a certain point of time, people form a certain coherence, and then we start talking of them as a people with a culture. And then later we may talk of them as a nation. So where and how did the nation soul come into existence? Is it just those characteristics that identify a culture by its commonalities? This is really a sort of, you know, similar problem to what you're talking about.
Yeah, beautiful.
My understanding of the thing is that nature has its way of developing approximations, that we move towards unities. But, you know, just as the process of evolution is a process that is dynamized from above, by a pressure from above, by entities which already exist, or planes of consciousness which already exist, so too these souls already exist, and by a pressure on the constituents of nature, start precipitating certain kinds of characteristics. Now these characteristics, when they develop a certain amount of density, they call down this soul. So the soul enters, but the soul has its own reality. It is an independent being. So that is the thing about the being of these archetypes, of the animals, let's say, as well as of the universal human. So universal human is a being, and that being, whatever you call it, Vishwamanu or whatever, it has a tapas, you may say. The tapas is its orientation towards the Supreme. That tapas creates the blueprint for the kind of journey that all human beings will undertake. Now that gets individualized in each human being. And so the human beings are in some way following a more generalized blueprint of gati, of movement towards the supermind that has been determined by the Vishwamana.
Beautiful, Devashita, just beautiful. So to continue that, yeah, very nice. So the while the individuals are in a way, in different ways, in their own ways, trying to follow that blueprint, what would the existence that is the Vishwamanu be doing? I mean, I don't know if the word doing is applicable in the realm of the soul, but what would the Vishwamanu be doing, for want of a different word?
Well, it would, you see, for example, you know, this is what the whole thing about cosmic movements is all about. And we can talk about it at the human level. You see, for example, today we talk about, the age of reason, right? And now, or the modern age, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our world has a certain look and feel. And that look and feel is not just, again, in an external matter, it is a matter of orientation of consciousness. Modern man has a certain orientation of consciousness which is different from pre-modern man. How did that universal orientation occur?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the whole thing that historians struggle with so much, because history is all about trying to find causes. We try to say that this event happened, that event happened, and they combined with each other, and such and such, such effect took place in human circumstance. But when we really look at it, we can't really pinpoint the causes. It's a sort of, it's not a conspiracy. That's the reason why people jump for these so-called conspiracy theories, because we have to try and explain it in terms of one cause. The mind tries to do that, but this is not the way it happens. It happens due to a cascading effect of many different events, some of them too subtle for our eye. But what has precipitated all these events is a shift in the tapas of the universal Manu. That is what is happening. So when that happens, an age changes. Humanity starts expressing, without knowing each other's sort of thoughts, similar kinds of things. And those kinds of things cascade to form a change of an age, so to say.
Fantastic. Very beautiful explanation.
That was really beautiful.
This is how, you see, we can see, I mean, modern thinkers are hard put to explain this thing, you know. And I think among Western philosophers, Nietzsche is the first one who observes this, who makes note of this. And then philosophers who have followed him, who have thought in the wake of his thinking, have constantly referred to this. In the great philosopher Michel Foucault talks about epistemic changes. He says that epistemes, ways of thinking, ways of knowing actually, our knowledge modality suddenly changes without our knowing why. We can't put a finger on it. It's not a conspiracy. It's not that a lot of people got together and decided now we are going to think this way, but an age completely changes. How does it happen? The way they use more kind of, you know, refined language to express it, they say there is a change in the orientation of beings towards being. But that is the same thing. How did that change occur? It occurred due to some shift of tapas in some controlling being. And that is the Vishwamana.
So when in the process of sadhana you identify with that Vishwamana, then it's possible for you to also participate in that tapas, you would say?
Vishishtha, from that perspective, like let us say in an age where lot of anarchy and lack of harmony, and sometimes these effects are more apparent in some times than others. Let us say during that time, the tapas of the Vishwamana is also getting affected in subtle ways. Is something similar to that? Is this some kind of a manifestation of disturbances of that tapas?
Generally speaking, Prakriti does not influence the tapas of the Vishwamana. It's the other way around. But human beings at the individual plane have so much power, because the transcendent dwells in each of us, that at an advanced stage, any individual can change the tapas of the Vishwamana. This is the whole idea of yoga. This is, in a way, Sri Aurobindo's idea about the change of the age to the supramental age. He has brought it about. He and the mother have changed the tapas of the Vishwamana as individuals, because they have invoked a power greater than that of the human cosmic individual. So at the individual level, it's possible at a very high stage of yoga, but generally Prakriti has no effect upon the tapas of the Vishwamana. Prakriti is caused by the tapas of the Vishwamana. When chaos takes place, it is usually due to a transition in that particular tapas. You know, like in the Gita, when the Vishwarup Darshan is being shown, Sri Krishna is saying, it is I who have arisen as the Lord of War, as the Lord of Time, to swallow these people, to create this war. That chaos is created by the Supreme Being Himself, because that is necessary at that time. We cannot comprehend it. It is beyond our comprehension. And that's why Arjuna says, no, I can't take it anymore. Reveal to me your six-handed form, or your four-handed form. But this is the fact that Prakriti's movements are ultimately the result of those changes in the Vishwamana.
Thank you.
So that vision that Arjuna had is the vision of the cosmic of the Vishwa Manu. Oh, Vishwa Rupa. Okay, I guess that's what.
No,
it.
No,
no, it's
no,
not.
No, no, not at all, not at all. I'm using it as an analogy.
Ah, okay.
What Arjuna has is the vision of the supramental being. He has a vision of the supreme being of the Purushottama in his supramental form.
Okay. So similarly, all the groups, the group soul and the animals are all in different ways.
Aurobindo is talking about the coming of the, in the vision of Ashwapati, the turn of the age, you know, as he is speaking to the Divine Mother, he presages it with this vision of a great destruction. He says, a giant dance of Shiva toward the past. He hears the sort of, you know, the battle cry in his ears. And then he sees these sort of, you know, beings of the supramental world come crowding down the amber stairs of birth. So these changes are also presaged by deeper occult movements. We are not the cause of these things. We can prevent these things by the power of yoga, but that is another matter.
So the group soul and all the animals and such also have their own tapas in their own form.
Yeah, that is what maintains the law dharma of that animal.
So Debashida, a little more details about this. The tapas, the shift of tapas in the Vishwamana, is it like an age of reason, like the age of enlightenment, then the age of communism, then the age of capitalism? Can we say it is in that granularity, or it's much vaster?
Well, yes, it is in that granularity. But then, you know, if you talk about these occult phenomena, you also have to see a gradation of beings. You know, as, for example, the mother talks about the Lord of Light, who was the Lord of Darkness, who got transformed to the Lord of Light. And she came across this being. And this being, she says, was behind the whole Bolshevik movement and the movement of communism, in a sense, in Russia prior to Stalin. So this kind of a, you know, sort of occult agency is a more subsidiary agency than the, you know, the sort of cosmic man or the cosmic being, a projection, a kind of vibhuti of that being. So a variety of actions take place out of the single being, depending on how high it is in the ladder of manifestation. So that's what explains the granularity. There are different levels of self-projection of the same grand cosmic tapas. It's various possible actions. It's like when Sri Aurobindo sort of launched the Indian freedom movement, the Swadeshi movement, in Bengal, he started it on two prongs, both of non-violence and violence. So that kind of, you know, each one of these, you can say, is an idea force, which is independent and which will have its own power. But they're both serving the same change of tapas, the same goal, the eradication of colonialism, let's say. So that is how it works through a number of means, each one of them being an idea force with a being behind it, but all serving the same grand change.
How do you say with a with a being behind it?
Yeah. Each one of these, we can think of them as principles, but these are just not principles. They're not just principles or even universal forces. They are also beings. It depends on how you look at it. Somebody has said that Sri Aurobindo looked at all these things like a scientist. So he saw them as forces. But the mother looked at the same things as an occultist. She saw them as beings. She actually dealt with each of these forces as an actual person, a being.
So that's again only, I mean, not only, in, so those are again perspectives, you would say, and there might be other perspectives too, or?
Yeah, but these are two major perspectives. They're both true at the same time. It depends on one's perspective on them, but the two major are personal and impersonal. Mm. So these are the personal and impersonal sides of these things.
Mm. I think this debate of Sakar and Nirakar was quite hot at the time of this Brahmo Samaj and Sri Ramakrishna. Right? That is what it is, right? Yeah. One of them is Sakar and one of them is Nirakar.
Yes, yes.
So, Devashishtha, how do we...
Keka, you were saying something?
Yeah, I was saying that was very nice. You were talking about this mother's beings and serving those forces. I mean, I was also thinking, like, how about, you know, looking at these beings as the limbs of the person and the being as the heart of the person, something like that. It was nothing serious.
Yes, certainly it's something like very, very much so, because this is the Purusha, the center of the Purusha and its various peripheries. But each of them has its kind of, you know, movement, which is specific, but controlled from that center.
So, Devashita, how do we compare this with, with the planes of, you know, the higher mind, the illumined mind, the intuitive mind, the over mind? So, how does that compare with the tapas of, the tapas of the Vishwamanu, so to say? I mean, I was thinking that many of these are ideas that people catch from these planes rather than the result of some kind of tapas of the universal man. I mean, are the two concepts different, or are they really different ways of saying the same thing?
Yeah, they're different ways of saying the same thing. They are different ways of saying the same thing. these, again, it's the same thing, the akar and nirakar aspects of the same thing. These planes of consciousness are basically states of consciousness that these beings sort of carry. The whole of the overmind is the plane of consciousness called the overmind, is the state of consciousness of the overmental Purusha. Similarly, the state of consciousness of the illumined mind Purusha is the plane of consciousness known as illumined mind. So Vishwamanav, which is most probably a being of the overmind, would have its variety of subsidiary actions or idea forces operating at all these planes, each one of them a being, but also each one of them, you know, projecting through a certain state of consciousness, which would then be received either as an idea from the illumined mind or an idea from some other mind. But basically, they're still beings of those planes.
Okay. Very, yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. Very nice.
I'm really sorry if nobody minds. I was interrupted by a calling bell. Would you be able to repeat just the part that you said right after I asked the question? I'm really sorry about this.
Your question about the heart and the limbs. That question?
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, I was saying yes, absolutely, because in a way it is a sort of a relationship of hierarchy between a being and its projections, each one of them having specific functions, but ultimately coordinated and controlled by the central being. This is very true. And to the extent that this central being has power over these, or let me rephrase it, the higher it is, the more power it has over the subsidiary beings that it controls. So the higher you go, the more clear it is. You see, what happens is that, for example, let's say the same being has spawned the notions. You see, the Sri Aurobindo, let's go back to this very important idea that Sri Aurobindo introduces about the coming of the modern age. He says the three major sort of idea forces that are behind the coming of the modern age were announced in the French Revolution. They are liberty, equality, and fraternity. Now, these therefore become three of the major manasputras of the Vishwaman. You see, they are the mind-born idea forces that the Vishwamanu has thrown out to change the age into the modern age. Now, these operate independently, but they are at the same time controlled by the Vishwamanu. So that's where your notion of the limbs and the heart comes in. But when we receive them, it depends on our state of consciousness. If we receive them in a fragmented way, then we produce different philosophies or ideologies out of each of these that then enter into war with one another. It seems almost as if they are, one being fighting with itself. From the higher plane, that's what it would look like. But at the lower plane of fragmentation, this discord can come about. Nevertheless, that discord will ultimately end in a harmony, in a synthesis, in which they are seen to be, the coordinated limbs of the one being.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's very nice that this idea of the Vishwamanu came up, because I think you clarified a lot of very beautiful things in the last 15-20 minutes. Very nice.
Ultimately, Vishwamanu idea also sort of is, dependent upon our state of consciousness. What is the origin of the Vishwamanu? Ultimately, one may say that the Vishwamanu is no other than the transcendental Purushottama, because it is the Purushottama, the Supreme Person, that is personifying itself in each individual in the cosmos. So that is again self-projected as the universal man. But when we approach it, our state of highest consciousness will define for us what we see in it. We may see it in the overmind, but ultimately our gaze may overpass and see its origin in the supermind. So then we see that it is the supramental Purusha, that is, the Vishwamanu is none other than the supramental Purusha. That's where the coordinated, integrated, or the integral tapas of the Vishwamanu is really effective. You see, below that we start getting gradually more and more fragmented actions that we cannot understand. We think that everything is a chaos because we are operating from this chaotic standpoint of differentiation. But it is all, like Keka was saying, the limbs of the one being at work to create the one change of movement. From supermind's point of view, it is always that. It is always a harmonious and coordinated turn to a new law.
I mean, when we talk about limbs and heart, that itself has this kind of thing inbuilt, like the heart as if we are talking about a higher gradation of consciousness, which has much more integral view than the limbs, though ultimately both present the same being. So, and so on. So, basically, if there is any higher gradation, that will see again that heart as one limb of another higher being, so on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
So even in those beings, those states between the present human and the supramental, there would be different, I mean, just like we see things in fragmented forms, even in those levels, there will be a different level of fragmentation, but fragmentation nevertheless, correct?
Relative fragmentations, the higher we go, the less. You see the differences, for example, as you know, Sri Aurobindo points out that the gods, let's say in the whether in the illumined mind or in the intuitive mind or certainly in the over mind, they don't fight with each other. They act in concord. They may not know themselves to be parts of the same being. You see, that's the thing. The difference between over mind and super mind is that overwhelming sense of unity, of identity is lacking. Sense of unity may be there, but sense of identity is lacking. That we are not only limbs of one being, we are the same being in these various forms. So that, you know, sense of absolute identity is the experience of that same Vishwamanavin supermind. But the experience at lower levels of universal mind is still one of harmony, is one of concord, is one of cooperation. That's why we sort of move down, and it's only in the vital that they start becoming fragmented by a light of differentiation that is so sharp that they become contested forces. They are co-opted, they are taken over by warring sort of beings. This is one of the problems that is brought out so well in the triple soul forces in Savitri, where the goddesses have to compromise. Though they are aspects of the supreme being, they have to compromise, and each one act completely separately and also coexist with their darkened opposites. Those deformed vahanas that they have to carry with them wherever they go.
Debashish, regarding Vishwamanav and collective meditation or collective yoga, I have a small doubt. It sounds to me more of a mystery to me, because Arjuna, when Arjuna gave up and said to Paramatma, I can't do this and I can't fight with my own kith and kin and I don't want to do, then Vishwamanav said that, or Paramatma said that this is my Leela. You are only Nimitta Matra and you are doing according to my play.
Right.
So, but recently, like not recently, but so many philosophies out there says that collective yoga can bring a lot of peace into the world, and it can change all the chaos, it can eliminate, I think one of our discussions you also mentioned, it can alter this chaos or whatever the play of Vishwamanav, it can alter the path of it. So it sounds more of a mystery to me, because when Arjuna prayed to Paramatma and said that I can't do it, but still Paramatma went ahead and did what is supposed to be done at that time, when there are so many conscious souls around, like Vidura, Kunti, Bhishma, Karna, everybody. In today's world, if we see that, how this collective yoga is going to help us, because still, finally, it's all going to be Paramatma's Leela, right?
Yeah.
So even...
No, no doubt. There's no doubt about that. But you see, the thing is that, you know, we may have the best wishes. And actually, Sri Krishna is saying that he has tried his best to bring about peace. See, he is acting on many levels. At the human level, he is upholding the dharma of peace. He is trying to bring about, he tried his best, but it did not work out. That is his so-called human reasoning that he is giving. But you see, because we can see only a fragment of the truth, and we may have good wishes, but our good wishes are not wise enough, you see. So we can't see what are the forces involved. See, during the First World War, there was somebody who asked Sri Aurobindo, this is, a kind of an answer that he gave to somebody asking him about the First World War, that why did this have to happen, this enormous world war? So many lives were lost. And his answer was, without it happening, it would be impossible to exhaust the forces of the past, which had become a hindrance to the emergence of the future. Now, this only the Vishwamanav can see. We cannot see this. We have only our good wishes at best. These good wishes are sattvic, but they are not transcendental. We wish that we could arrive at harmony through collective meditations and collective yoga and things like that. And we are welcome to try, because by trying only we can know. We cannot know until and unless we enter into the mind of God. If we do, then we'll know what is exactly required, you know. But in the meantime, we have to do our best. So if one has a certain inspiration, that it is through collective meditation or through collective yoga that the harmony of the world can increase, they should follow that dharma but offer it to the divine. Because ultimately, we don't know whether divine wants that or not. This is only a mental ideal. So if the divine wishes that, no, now the time has come for giant dance of Shiva to tear the past, then that will happen and we will have to accept that. But in the meantime, the force that we have put into bringing about some higher law of dharma is not lost. It will continue to exert its pressure even beyond whatever destruction takes place.
Thank you. It's very well said. Thank you.
Yeah, ultimately, whatever we think is good is at the best of what is good. Until and unless we arrive at the supermind, we cannot know what is necessary at the next moment. So that's the exact.
Actually, your first sentence, I'm sorry, your first sentence got cut off. I don't know if it's for everyone. What is good and then? At the best? It is something you said.
Actually, first part of the sentence was lost, I think. I also couldn't hear the first part.
Yeah, but now
yeah,
Devashisda
no
is gone.
He dropped.
Intentions. Hello, am I heard?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yes.
So, I was saying, whatever we do with however good intentions, we can never know whether that is what the divine wants at this moment until we enter the supermind, or at least high enough to see the unfragmented action of these ideas. So, if we do that, let's say even if we are operating from illumined mind, or we are opened sufficiently to the visions or perceptions of the illumined mind, then there is a certain degree of, you know, sort of wisdom or intuition of how to align our will. But prior to that, as Krishna is being told by, as Arjuna is being told by Krishna, he has to act from the highest consciousness available to him, but with a total surrender of the action to the divine. And that surrender becomes the you know, sort of means of yoga, the means of purification and clarification, whereby circumstances and inner consciousness are gradually aligned by the divine to the divine will. So whatever we may consider to be good, this should be done, should be undertaken, but with a pinch of salt, because we really don't know whether that is what the divine wants. And if tomorrow divine changes it completely, then, until we arrive at the vision of why that happened, we just have to accept it with the surrender.
So, an analogy comes to my mind. Let us say in the night, when you are walking, try to walk at least with a small torch light or small whatever light you can carry with you.
Yeah.
Try to walk with that, unless until a big flashlight is thrown upon you and you are anyway taken and all that, that's good. But to the extent possible, try to walk with the light. Otherwise, chances of you getting into a ditch are pretty high.
Absolutely. I would add to that analogy that in the dark, always walk with whatever small light you have in your hand, but also at every step keep calling out, knowing that somebody is there with a huge light there that can see you and see the ground as well. Because that being can give you the message at the right moment to do what is necessary, or can actually push you, even without your knowing it, to avert the danger.
That is a very good analogy, Sita.
Actually, on lighter side, I'm sorry, but on the lighter side in LA, if somebody has a bigger light and watching you from the top, you are in real danger because of so many police chases in LA or car thefts.
Sounds like those helicopters above.
Yeah, on your head, and you're running for a. Finally, they'll catch you. So, except for LA, I think in the spiritual sense, it's true.
Okay, we can read one more and finish there.
Monica, would you like to read?
Dibhashita, one last question before we read.
Okay.
This Virat Purusha, is he also the Vishwamana?
What Virat is actually technically used for, I think, the universal being in the Jagrat condition. And that means that, there are again, those sort of the three triple division of the avasthas. So supreme being, conscious being, has got one part of it which is objectified, the objectified part with its base in matter and its heights in spirit. So that particular condition of experience is upheld by a universal being called Virat.
Oh, so it's an aspect of the Vishwamana.
Yes.
Oh, same way, I think the Swapna aspect is Hiranyagarbha.
Yes.
And there must be something for the Sushupti.
Yes. What is it? Tejasa or something. Mm.
Tejasa is the Tejasa is the Swapna, and the Hiranyagarbha is the Sushupti.
Yes.
Sushupti means superconscient or super.
Yes, superconscient.
Superconscient sleep or something. Yeah.
Superconscient sleep, and in a way, Sri Aurobindo's sort of interpretation is pointing to that as actually not necessarily a sleep, but a sleep whose boundaries can be pushed further and further back.
I mean, like inward consciousness, basically.
Inward consciousness would be the Swapna, and the Sushupti would be more like the one that transcends subject and object. So outer and inner are both transcended by it.
The turn towards itself, like that way inward.
Yeah, turn towards. Sushupti is literally that, sleeping in sleep, so to say. Turn inward towards, into oneself.
Oh, so you're saying Jagrat is the objective, Swapna is the subjective, and Sushupti is beyond both.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a nice way of putting it.
Shall I read?
Yes.
Yeah.
To suppose otherwise would be to suppose that spirit which now presides over the human soul experience was originally formed by the human mentality and the human body, exists by that and cannot exist apart from it, cannot ever go below or above it. In fact, it would then be reasonable to suppose that it is not immortal but has come into existence by the appearance of the human mind and the body in evolution and would disappear by their disappearance. But body and mind are not the creators of the spirit. The spirit is the creator of the body, of the mind and the body. It develops these principles out of its being. It is not developed into being out of them. It is not a compound of their elements or a resultant of their meeting. If it appears to evolve out of mind and body, that is because it gradually manifests itself in their meeting. If it appears to evolve out of mind and body, that is because it gradually manifests itself in them and not because it is created by them or exists by them as it manifests. They are revealed as subordinate terms of its being and are finally taken up out of the present imperfection and transformed into visible forms and instruments of the spirit. Our conception of the spirit is of something which is not constituted by name and form, but assumes various forms of body and mind according to the various manifestations of its soul being. This it does here by a successive evolution. It evolves successive forms and successive strata of consciousness, for it is not bound always to assume one form and no other, or to possess one kind of mentality which is its sole possible subjective manifestation. The soul is not bound by the formula of mental humanity. It did not begin with that and will not end with it. It had a pre-human past. It has a superhuman future. Hello?
Shall we take up this next week? Or?
Yeah, I think let's take it up next week. Let's end over here for the time being and take it up next week.
Okay.
Let's end with the meditation.